This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. North Korean state media reported that Pyongyang carried out successful tests of a new long-range cruise missile over the weekend. And the report said that the missiles flew about 1,500 kilometers, or 930 miles, before hitting their targets and falling into the country's territorial waters. It was seen as the North's first missile launch after it tested a new tactical short-range ballistic missile in March. North Korea also conducted a cruise missile test just hours after U.S. President Joe Biden took office in late January. Talks aimed at dismantling the North's nuclear and ballistic missiles program in return for U.S. sanctions relief have stalled since the year 2019. The Biden administration has said that it is open to diplomacy to achieve North Korea's denuclearization, but so far it has shown no willingness to ease those sanctions. A reactivation of inter-Korean hotlines in July raised hopes for a restart of the negotiation, but the North stopped answering calls as annual South Korea-U.S. military exercises began last month, which Pyongyang had warned could trigger some type of crisis. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi became the first foreign leader on Sunday to visit and meet with Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi since the hardliner took office in August. Raisi said Iraq had agreed to waive visas for Iranian pilgrims to Shiite holy sites in Iraq later this month, adding decisions were also made about the two countries' financial issues that should be adopted. Iraq relies on Iranian gas and electricity. This is VOA News. The Taliban government in Afghanistan said Sunday women can continue to pursue university and postgraduate studies in public and private institutions as long as classrooms or building structures are gender segregated. At a news conference Sunday, the Taliban's acting education minister defended segregating students by gender. He said coeducation is against Islamic tenets and Afghan cultural traditions. The minister said that only female teachers will be allowed to teach female students. He added that there will be no shortage of women teachers. He also said if necessary, men could teach women from behind a curtain, nor use any video screens in accordance with ultra-conservative Islamic law known as Sharia. Under the Taliban's 1996 to 2001 government in Afghanistan, women's rights were sharply curtailed, leading the country's international isolation at the time. Women were barred from leaving home without a male relative, and girls were not permitted to receive an education. Since returning to power nearly a month ago, the Taliban promised to defend human rights and allow women to study or work. Afghanistan must provide those conditions in order to receive international financial assistance. The Taliban established an all-male caretaker government last week, days after the United States and Western allies withdrew their troops from Afghanistan. Iran's atomic energy body said Sunday it will allow the UN nuclear watchdog to service monitoring cameras at Iranian nuclear sites after talks with the International Atomic Energy Agency. The talks were aimed at easing a standoff between Tehran and the West just as it threatens to escalate and threaten negotiations on reviving the Iran nuclear deal. The IAEA said earlier there had been no progress on two key issues, explaining uranium traces found at old undeclared sites and getting urgent access to monitoring equipment so the agency can continue to keep track of parts of Iran's nuclear program as per the 2015 deal. Two French politicians have kicked off their presidential campaigns to become France's first female leader in next year's spring election. Far-right National Rally Party's Marine Le Pen and Paris's socialist mayor Anne Hidalgo both launched their platforms on Sunday. Le Pen is 53 and started her campaign in the southern city with a pledge to defend French liberty, and Hidalgo, whose heritage is Spanish, is the favorite to win the Socialist Party nomination. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Daybreak Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, September 13, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan religious leaders say no political speeches in their churches.
This has to be said clearly. Dear politicians, if you're coming to pray in our churches, you're welcome. And sit like any other ordinary Christian. And please, do not expect to address people in our churches.
Angolan opposition parties protest election bill, which seeks to centralize vote counting. Botswana sees a drastic reduction in COVID-19 infections. A Liberian female political leader says she has not sought to be the running mate of any potential presidential candidate. And Liberia's opposition is called upon to first be law-abiding.
As the saying goes in Liberia, you will know if the Christmas is good by the eve. If we, as prospective leaders of Liberia, if we are making our case to Liberian people, the replaced president we are, we gotta start now by setting the right examples.
And a new Global Witness report sheds new light on the murder of environmental activists around the world. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Religious leaders from Anglican and Catholic churches have called out politicians who they say are using the pulpit as their campaign grounds, a habit which has become the trend since the ban on political gatherings in Kenya as a measure to curb the spread of COVID-19. As Atien Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, the archbishops also ask other churches to follow suit by preventing politicians from turning church services into political rallies.
Speaking during the historic consecration of the first female bishop of the Anglican Church in Kenya, attended by opposition leader Raila Odinga and other top politicians, including his opponents in the 2022 presidential race, Archbishop Jackson Ole Sapit barred the politicians from addressing the congregation. Sapit announced that the Anglican Church will no longer allow political utterances to be made from its pulpit.
In the recent past, we have also seen the church is becoming now the battleground for political expediency, and the church is no longer identified as a place of worship, and the media is not helping us in this respect, because whenever a sermon is given, they don't air it. They air political statements given in the church. The Anglican Church of Kenya is a no-go zone for political rhetoric and whatever happens. And if they want to address the press, they will address when the service is ended.
The remarks spewed mixed reactions and were not welcomed by some politicians who stormed out of the service after learning that they will not get an opportunity to address the huge congregation. Edwin Sifuna, the Secretary General of Raila Odinga's opposition ODM party, lauded the ban and criticized the presidential aspirant for storming out.
We were very ashamed as leaders from this region to see some of our purported presidential candidates storming out of a church event simply because the Archbishop Ole Sapit had announced that in fact no political discussions would take place. We are aware as ODM of heavy political mobilization by the ANC in Butere to make sure that there are people who are heckled, leaders who are applauded, and so on and so forth.
Archbishop Anthony Muheria of the Catholic Church reiterated the ban and requested all other churches to follow suit. Muheria appealed politicians to respect places of worship and attend church services only as regular worshippers.
They are demanding in churches, in places of worship, to have a political rally to address people politically. The Catholic Church has said it very clearly that we will not allow the politicians to speak in our churches. And this has to be said clearly. Dear politicians, if you are coming to pray in our churches, you are welcome. And sit like any other ordinary Christian. And please, do not expect to address people in our churches. Please come to pray and leave. Let us once more give respect to God's place.
A similar ban was issued last year by several churches. However, it was largely ignored. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
As Angola prepares for presidential election next year, opposition parties and civil society groups took to the streets over the weekend to protest a bill introduced in parliament by President João Lourenço, which seeks to consolidate the counting of votes rather than doing so at each local level. The ruling Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, the MPLA, has ruled the country since independence. Mario Pavai is a veteran independent Angolan journalist. He says the main opposition National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, UNITA, says it is ready to govern comes 2023 through real democracy, as opposed to what it calls the current one-party system.
Last Saturday, we have demonstrations of the so-called Patriotic Front, including UNITA, the Praja Project, despite it's not still legalized, and Bloco Democratico. We had demonstrations in Luanda, thousands of people, and also in some minor cities. The main leaders of UNITA, like President Adalberto Costa Jr., and also one leader from Bloco Democratico, Justino Pintandrat, and the other leaders, has been there with massive groups of mainly young people.
We understand that the bill that the opposition is protesting has to do with President Lourenço's proposal to centralize the counting of votes instead of doing it at each municipality. What is wrong with that? What does the opposition find to be wrong with that?
The opposition parties are saying that this kind of proceedings, not counting at the local level, at the municipality level, opens doors for fraud counting and don't help transparency in the electoral process. So the opposition parties want votes counting from the municipality till provincial level and then at the end at the central level, saying this will be a process with more transparency and scrutiny for the electoral process. So that they are proposing that the government needs to change the law. We are aware that in an unexpected mood, President Lourenço resent the project again for the National Assembly to reappreciate some clauses of the law as far as concerning the counting at the municipality level and the other levels.
That was Mario Paivai, a veteran independent Angolan journalist, speaking with us from the capital, Luanda. One of the leaders of Liberia's four opposition collaborating political parties, the CPP, says he will continue to remain a member of the collaboration because the CPP is the best vehicle by which Liberians can replace President George Weah and make him a one-term president. But Alexander Comis, the leader of the Alternative National Congress Party, says in order to do that, the opposition must first show its commitment to the rule of law. Liberia will have presidential elections in 2023, when President George Weah will be running for his second term. There has been a lot of wrangling in the opposition. Last Friday, Mr. Comis stormed out of a CPP political leaders meeting because of what he calls repeated violations of the CPP framework agreement. Comis said what's at stake is restoring good governance in Liberia.
I just want to remind Liberians and all of your listeners of what's at stake. And what's at stake is restoring good governance to Liberia, to making Mr. Weah a one-term president. And as the saying goes in Liberia, you will know if the Christmas is good by the eve. And if we, as prospective leaders of Liberia, if we are advocating, if we're making our case to Liberian people to replace President Weah, we got to start now by setting the right examples. Yes, I did walk out of the meeting. I thought it was symbolically important that I did that. And the reasons are as follows. We did have a previous meeting where we agreed to some actions. And I supported those decisions. I did it in good faith, in the interest of collegiality. I agreed to that and fully admit no disclaimer around that. But immediately after the meeting, as I always do, I went and met with the leadership of the ANC to debrief them on what we had agreed. And one of those acts that we have agreed was to extend the term of Senator Yonah Lawrence as chair of the CPP. And very respectfully, but very firmly, party leadership said, as a political leader, with all due respect, you did not have that authority, you collectively, to extend Senator Lawrence's term, and there's no provision in the framework agreement to do so. With that understanding and the confirmation that that was the case, I reached out to my colleagues and said, look, we did this collectively in good faith. I was a part of this, but we need to correct it. It's actually a show of strength as opposed to a show of weakness, because we have to follow the quote-unquote constitution we've agreed to amongst ourselves. But of course, we came upon resistance. It didn't happen, and I didn't think it was worthwhile to sit and keep repeating myself clear violations of our framework agreement, and so I walked out of the meeting.
So, Mr. Cummins, in the wake of your assertions that the other three political parties are violating the guidelines, are you going to stay within or walk away?
No, I do not intend to leave the CPP. I still think the CPP is the best vehicle by which we can replace President Weah and make him a one-term president. This act was to demonstrate my commitment to the rule of law, my commitment to living up to the agreements that we signed. And whether we've had precedents in the past or things we've done in the past, if it was incorrect, does not justify continuing it if it's inconsistent with, quote unquote, our constitution, meaning the constitution of the CPP, which is the framework agreement.
Mr. Cummins, thanks once again for taking the time to speak with me. I do appreciate it very much.
Thank you, JB. Anytime, I'll be happy to have a conversation with you.
Alexander Cummins is the leader of the Alternative National Congress Party, which is also part of the four-party opposition collaborating political parties of Liberia. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. In Liberia, one of the female leaders of a major opposition political party in the country says she has not had conversations with either former Vice President Joseph Boakai of the Unity Party or Alexander Cummins of the opposition Alternative National Congress Party about being a vice presidential candidate during Liberia's 2023 presidential election. Senator Nyombli Kanga Lawrence, who is leader of the opposition Liberty Party, says her party is the second largest party in the opposition collaborating political parties, the CPP, and if any of the potential presidential candidates would like for her to be their running mate, they must negotiate with the Liberty Party and not the other way around. This comes as the opposition CPP is in the process of choosing a standard bearer for the 2023 general election. It also comes as there continues to be what some say is wrangling in the CPP. Just last week, Alexander Cummins walked out of a CPP leaders' meeting.
Mr. Cummins announced that he would not sit with the committee because he felt that our actions were against the framework document. I said to him as the chair of the CPP that the second highest decision-making body in the CPP is the National Advisory Committee or Council, and in the absence of the National Assembly of all the political parties. So when you don't have the convention, then it's the National Advisory Council that is the highest decision-making body. In that council, the chairpersons of the political parties, the heads of the legislative caucuses of the party, and just one or two other partisans who are appointed to that council are not decision-makers. They are just observers. So the decisions are still made by the four political leaders. So the committee was formed in that regard, and we asked, well, if we need to discuss it, then let's sit down and look over it, because the most we can do is call a meeting of the National Advisory Council if we need confirmation. And he said no, he would not sit in the meeting to have such a discussion, so he walked away.
I asked this question in my most recent interviews with Mr. Cummins and the former Vice President Boakai, and that is there a leadership crisis in the CPP?
Well, I don't think there's a leadership crisis in the CPP. The CPP is being led in the right direction. We are following all of the instructions and what we need to follow in our framework document. This time of consensus period, we know there will be a lot of issues that will be raised because the people want to be on these different tickets, either as the center bearer, as the vice center bearer. Political parties want to project their leaders Some of these leaders have to work in between political parties to get the support of their party, either through consensus or through the primaries. So what you're saying is what will happen normally in political processes, which I have to be steadfast and follow the right direction and ensure that the right decisions are made.
Senator, there are speculations that you and Senator Darius Dillon might have agreed that if former Vice President Joseph Boakai chooses you as his running mate for 2023, then that in exchange, you will support the former Vice President during the CPP primary voting. Your reaction to that, please.
Well, Mr. Bode, the Liberty Party is the second largest party in the CPP. So I don't know why we would want to go that route to negotiate just because we want to support someone. I think people should be negotiating with us, because as the second largest party in the CPP, we got more votes than the second two parties. And so if we want to be on a vice presidential ticket, it can be with anyone, Cummings, it can be with Joseph Boakai, and they have to reach out to us. I have not spoken to Joseph Boakai about being any candidate on the CPP ticket. I have not spoken to Mr. Cummings in Africa as well.
Senator Kanga Lawrence, it's so nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for this interview. I appreciate it.
Senator Nyombli Kanga Lawrence is the leader of the opposition Liberty Party of Liberia. She was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Monday, September 13. Botswana, which once had the world's highest coronavirus infection rates, has seen a drastic reduction in transmission. The COVID-19 task force reported on Thursday that the Southern African country has seen a six-fold reduction in cases, the first time since the pandemic began. From Haburuni, reporter Mkundise Dube has the details.
In July, Botswana was recording an average of 67 cases per 100,000 people, making the country one of the top five COVID-19 hotspots in the world. Last month, President Mokgweetsi Masisi painted a gloomy picture as the country faced an unprecedented rise in infections.
We have recorded an exponential increase in positive cases and fatalities, severely straining our fragile healthcare system. Our nation has attained the highest prevalence ever. Evidence of deaths is conspicuous and worrisome to all of us.
But after recording more than 2,000 deaths in the last 4 months, Botswana is now breathing a sigh of relief with a drop in the infection rate. Musipili Musipili is the COVID-19 Task Force Vice Chairperson.
On this day of the 6th of September, Botswana had an estimated 3,302 active cases, a six-fold drop in the highest number of active cases that this country has ever experienced during the current surge.
Botswana had seen its COVID-19 vaccination program slow down at the end of a devastating third wave. But there was more positive news this week as the country received 400,000 doses of China's Sinovac vaccines, the highest thus far. President Masisi says at least 64% of the eligible adult population will be fully vaccinated by the end of October.
The total number of vaccines expected this month, together with those that have been received so far, will mean that by the end of October 2021, 975,782 Botswana will be fully vaccinated, translated into 64% of the target population being fully vaccinated.
Nearly 10% of Botswana's population, or 220,000 people, are fully vaccinated. At least 361,878 people have received a single dose of the vaccine. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Haburuni, Botswana.
A new report out from Global Witness says at least 227 community and environmental activists were murdered globally in 2020. One of those was Fikile Nshangazi, who fought for community rights against a mining project in the Umfolozi community of South Africa. Her colleague Israel Nkosi, a leader with the Umfolozi Community Environmental Justice Organization, where Nshangazi also worked, spoke with Ricky Stryak about her work and legacy.
The Fikile Jangase was one of our comrades. She was a very dedicated person to her work. In most cases, when we are going to have meetings, even if it's preparation of the meetings, you will find her saying, when we say, Fikile, can your village do this for us? She says, hey, I can't take a decision. I will go back to them and consult. And maybe sometimes I'll laugh, say, you can take that decision. No, people send me. So as people have chosen me and they have trusted me and they have sent me, so I need to do all the things by their way. That was the kind of a person Fikile was. She was a wonderful grandma. She was a mother to her daughter, which is Nomalungelo. She knew Fikile was gunned down about 6 or 7 bullets at home. Indeed, I came to her home. I saw everything before even police arrived. I saw her lying down, helpless. And I still have that thing in my mind, that picture and everything, that I saw her lying down, that I said, oh, my soldier is gone.
She was mainly working at the time of her death on this mine near her hometown. Can you tell me a little bit about what was happening right up to her death and what's happening now?
We fought. We decided, before even we formed that, we decided to approach the mine to say, we can't be the neighbor of mine. We took them to court. When we arrived there, the decision was in their favor. After that, we appealed. They said we must pay the court cost. We paid that. We need to appeal. We appeal again. We go further in the Court of Supreme in Bloemfontein. There was that. They did won again in the case. And they're saying, no, we cannot close the mine. The mine is there and there and all those things.
That was Israel Nkosi, a leader of the Umfolozi Community Environmental Justice Organization. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from South Africa. It's time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin with sports with the English Premier League, where Egyptian forward Mohamed Salah's 100th Premier League goal helped Liverpool cruise to a 3-0 victory at 10-man Leeds United on Sunday to become the second African to score 100 Premier League goals after Didier Drogba. After a lightning-fast start to the game, Salah became the 30th player to join the Premier League's 100th goal club in the 20th minute, tapping home from close range from a Trent Alexander-Arnold cross. Liverpool coach Jurgen Klopp was full of praises for Mohamed Salah.
Since he joined us, he's what a player. And still hungry. I saw him in the dressing room. He was still not happy for not scoring one or two other goals. That's it. That's how top-class players are, and it's fine.
Also in the same game on Sunday, Senegal international Sadio Mane put one away in stoppage time to put the icing on the cake and make it 10 points from 12 so far for this season for Liverpool, as Klopp's side stretched their unbeaten Premier League run to 14. On Saturday, it was Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang who was back on target for Arsenal as the Gabonese striker lifted the pressure on manager Mikel Arteta as they secured their first points of the Premier League season with their 1-0 victory over Norwich City at the Emirates Stadium. Another African, Wilfred Zaha from Ivory Coast, opened his account for this season for his Crystal Palace side against Tottenham Hotspur as he scored from the penalty spot in their 3-0 drubbing of Tottenham. Staying with football news, Croatia Zvarko Rogarusic on Sunday became the second coaching casualty of the 2022 World Cup group phase qualifying in Africa when he was fired by Zimbabwe. The 55-year-old paid the price for the Warriors' poor start in Group G this month with a scoreless home draw against South Africa, followed by a 1-0 away loss to Ethiopia, leaving them bottom of the table. A National Football Association statement said it would like to inform the football fraternity and the nation at large that it has amicably parted ways with senior team coach Zvarko Rogarusic. His exit follows that of Hossam El Badri, who was asked as coach of Egypt and replaced by former Real Madrid manager and Manchester United assistant Carlos Queiroz. in the CAF Champions League preliminary fixture played across various venues this past weekend, Gambian champions Fortune FC started their CAF Champions League 2021-2022 campaign with an emphatic 3-0 win over 2014 Champions League winners Algeria's ES Setif in Baku. Kenyan champions Tusker FC picked up a crucial away goal as it played to a 1-1 draw against Djibouti side Arata Solar 7 in Djibouti City on Saturday. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, September 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington.